Okay, and we're back. Hour number two, talking with Dr. Michael Sala about a lot of very interesting things. We're sort of stuck in a coasting phase here now. The government is probably trying to decide when it's time to give up this ludicrous cover-up that they've been maintaining for 65 years plus. And I don't know who's going to win. I, again, don't really care because I think people like Bill Tompkins and others, Dr. Bob Wood and so many others over the years who've been on this program who have come forward telling their stories, telling what they've seen, leads us to the point now where we know there are things flying around above us, machines that land, that leave Earth, that can do incredible things that shouldn't be able to be done in terms of physics, but do, that are, in all probability, in many cases, ours. Because of the advanced technology that Bill Tompkins learned about in the early 1940s from the German spies, our spies on Germany who were brought back, they're Americans, who came back here to report and were debriefed, and he was able to watch these and interact with these people. So he learned early on during the war years that the technology was already there to take us off planet. Now, there was a fellow in England, John, what's his name? Walston, I think I want to say. He had a telescope and was able to capture items that were in orbit, rather deep orbit, around Earth that were parked there. And these look like enormous spaceships. Not Buck Rogers kinds of things, but just more like you'd see in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Do you remember seeing any of these pictures, Michael, when they came out? I had many of them on the site. John Walson, I think, was his name. He went by that name, right? Anyway.
Yes, I remember seeing some of those pictures, and they kind of substantiate that there was a secret set of space stations in orbit around the Earth. And I think that this is one of the aspects of the secret space programs as they've developed, that there are several of them that we need to kind of like look at in terms of having developed concurrently, which is something that's very important. You know, we've talked about, you know, what the Nazis did in South America and Antarctica. Bill Tompkins talked about what the Navy was doing in terms of developing these battle groups, these kilometer-long space cruisers and carriers that were basically going to be deployed in deep space. But I think, especially in the United States, as you know, all the different military services, they tend to kind of develop particular areas of expertise.
Yeah.
And I think the Air Force and the National Reconnaissance Office, they were tapped to look after near-Earth orbits, basically make sure that any traffic to the Earth was under surveillance, and to kind of like form a last line of defense, if you like, against any kind of attack against the Earth. That I think that in terms of the military thinking, that would make sense. So you have the Navy out there with their forward deployed space battle groups, and if anything got through the Navy battle groups, then you would have the NRO, Air Force, space platforms with all of these advanced weapons, directed energy weapons technologies up there that fulfilled a number of functions, partly surveillance, then also defense, and then also kind of attack against any satellites that were deployed by nations who might have in any way interfered with the plans. And I found it very interesting, and I'm sure you probably covered this material at some point, the information from Peter Beda from the late 70s to, I think it was 82, where there were these wars or these battles between the Air Force and the Russians up there. And I think that kind of makes a lot of sense, that there was this kind of effort to find out who would basically be in control of near-Earth orbit operations. and that the Russians developed these Cosmospheres, and they basically competed against the NRO and the Air Force for dominance, and then eventually they reached some accommodation.
Yeah, that would have been the Soviets, of course. This Peter Beter is a very interesting figure who has all but vanished from history. He's just not talked about anymore, and he's well worth taking a look at, folks, if you're interested in doing some research. B-E-T-E-R, Peter Beter. Now, those pictures that I alluded to earlier that John was able to image with his telescope and recorded on his video recorder, and he used to send them to me all the time. He's pulled a lot of them down, but they obviously, clearly, with no ambiguity, were enormous machines up there. And they looked rather like that we would be building things like that. They were square, they were long, they were this, they were that. They weren't very strange, sci-fi looking, curvy, smooth craft. They were just enormous constructs, and it all fits. And then I found out, as you did, that we have at least two, and this is going back 15, 20 years, two satellites at stable geosync orbits 18,000 miles out, whose job it is to watch the planet and log all traffic coming and going to it. This told me a lot, too, back then, that there's a whole different thing going on. The NASA space program, and this doesn't demean the participation or the bravery of the astronauts involved. Some gave their lives. Was basically a misdirection, a canard. We were so far ahead of that, and are. It's not funny. But when you have a program like the Apollo program with an enormous rocket, the Saturn V, and all of a sudden the plug is pulled on the program to the extent that the Saturn V booster is destroyed, the equipment that made it is destroyed, the blueprints that design and engineers used to construct them were allegedly destroyed as well. You say, what the hell is going on here? So, yeah, I agree. It's too obvious that there are things far in excess of what the mainstream media tells Mr. and Mrs. America are going on out there. Now, I had got an email here. Can you please ask Dr. Sala, did the university tell him that UFOs are not real, and that's the reason you're not to teach about them? Did they tell you that they weren't real, or the truth that UFOs exist was too shocking to teach about? Did you ever get any ambiguous messages from them about their position on this thing? Did anyone admit to you that, yeah, they're there, but we just don't talk about that?
What I was told was basically that this area of research that I was doing was not appropriate for the university, and I actually got it in writing. So they sent me a letter of dismissal, and they just said exactly that my new area of research was not appropriate for the university, and this was a time to kind of like separate. Definitely. Just a topic that they felt was just not something.
Sounds like they stepped around it rather gently, in a way. Although being fired is never gentle. I think that given the grant money that keeps the universities functioning, people were well aware of what's at some level going on here. They almost have to be.
I remember talking to the dean of the school and talking all about the disclosure project and the evidence of the cover-up and all of these witnesses out there and basically saying, well, this is an area that really is very important and it's going to change how international studies is understood in the future. And the dean completely agreed with me, but he just said, when official disclosure happens, then we'll just get a couple of our professors to kind of like read up on the literature and start teaching courses. But they didn't want to have anything to do with it.
That's funny. But, yeah. All right.
Yeah.
We've talked about the atomic explosions in the Antarctic in 1958, three of them, supposedly high altitude. I've got that from two different sources I was able to track down. So they weren't ground bursts. They were more EMF kind of thing. Maybe they were warnings, threatening to the Soviets to let them know that, hey, there's nowhere you can hide. I don't know. It was Cold War time, 1958. Things were just getting hotter and hotter all the time. And we had the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Okay. Well, Bill Thompson. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to just quickly add there. I think that one of the things, if it's true that the U.S. military-industrial complex began cooperating with the Nazis in Antarctica, then I think it would have been in the interest of the U.S. To make the Soviets believe that nothing was happening, and so detonating atomic weapons down there might be one of the ways to do that, to kind of like fool them into thinking that, well, no, if there were joint bases, then they've been destroyed or they wouldn't be functioning any longer. But I think the U.S. definitely has been involved in operations down there for a long time.
Oh, yes, and I think that we have our underground boring and tunneling machines that are capable of extraordinary feats underground at a very rapid rate and may well have honeycombed much of Antarctic. The Antarctic, remember, it's not all ice like the Arctic is, folks. It's a landmass. It's a continent. And so you've got all the features there that we have here. Mountains, lakes, underground rivers, all kinds of things. Now, Corey Good and Tompkins, secret think tanks. Tell us your overview on that. So a lot of people don't know who Corey Good is, so let's do a little background on Corey.
Sure. Well, he is someone that says that he served in the secret space programs from 1987 to 2007, that he worked on a number of programs, beginning with the Solar Warden program that was run by the Navy, that he served on a research vessel for about 6 years, and then he was reassigned to another branch of the secret space programs, doing other work related to interrogation of extraterrestrial visitors, trying to extract information. And so he, after a 20-year tour of duty, where during that time, as part of his duties, he says that to properly conduct these duties as an intuitive empath, because his job was to kind of like determine whether people were telling the truth or not. And so a decision was made by someone that in order for him to better be able to do that job, that it was good for him to be able to brief himself or have access to briefing documents describing all aspects of the secret space programs in terms of how many there are, you know, what the history of it.
Right.
That's
the big secret. Boy, that's the big secret. Yeah.
So he says he had access to these smart glass pads, similar to an iPad, but just fully transparent glass, and that during his service, during his downtime, and even sometimes when he was on official duty, that he would just be going, reading through this thing, reading all about the history of the programs, the different missions, the different colonies on the moon, colonies on Mars, bases some of the moons of the outer planets, and reading about the history of the Germans and how the Germans developed their space programs, that this was everything that he was reading on these smart glass pads.
And this occurred while he was off planet.
Exactly. So from 1987 to 2007, he served for 20 years, and at the completion of that 20-year service, where he's reading all of this information, he's also performing all of these off-world missions, his time of service is over. Mm-hmm. So the first thing they did to him was that they did a thorough debrief, where he basically said everything that he could remember about what happened. Then they put him in this age regression machine where they regressed him physically in age 20 years. And then they basically sent him back in time 20 years. So he's now sent back from 2007. He's been age regressed physically 20 years back to 1986, 87. And then he's subjected to another debrief, and then his mind is wiped, and he's returned home only minutes after he was originally picked up for his 20-year tour of duty, which sounds incredible. He's not the first whistleblower to say that he went through this. There have been others before him. Michael Ralph, the Mars whistleblower, said he did the same, that something like that happened to him from 1976 to 1996. Another whistleblower just before Corey Good came on the scene, Randy Kramer, or Captain K, says that he also went through a similar 20-year tour of duty and then age regression, 1987 to 2007. So you have three different whistleblowers saying they have gone through a similar process.
Yeah, they call it 20 and back.
Exactly, the 20 and back. But then you have William Tompkins coming forward, and not only does William Tompkins confirm a lot of the information that Corey Good said he experienced and saw, but William Tompkins also said that he had a hand in the development of the age regression technology. That back from back in 1967 to 1971, when he worked at TRW, I think you covered this on one of the shows.
Yeah.
That he worked on developing this technology, and that it was something that was developed to the extent where eventually it was used on these 20 and back personnel. So you have Tompkins now, with all of his testimony and his credentials and the documents he has supporting his background, saying that he went, he did work on this stuff. And one of the other things about Tompkins is that I was able to track down two Navy officers that worked with Tompkins out of the Navy League officers in Medford, Oregon from 1985 to 1999, and they confirmed some of the things that Tompkins was saying about special projects, secret space programs, and extraterrestrial life. So there you have two witnesses, credible witnesses, actually confirming that Tompkins was playing a role in educating Navy officers and their children in the Sea Cadets about these kinds of off-world programs.
That's fascinating. I live about 20 miles from Medford right now, and had no idea that was going on up here. We've had some remarkable sightings over the years in this area. So Mount Shasta is 90 minutes south of where I am. And I guess you're going to be appearing there this summer, aren't you, at a conference?
That's right. Yes, I'm going to be there in end of August with Corey Good and a couple of other presenters. And what's interesting about Mount Shasta is that this, according to Bill Tompkins, was one of the special projects that was run out of Medford, that they had a lot of Navy pilots flying around Mount Shasta trying to spot the passageways or the entrances into the underground bases used by the extraterrestrials or the inner Earth beings or civilizations that were using Mount Shasta as their kind of hidden base. So this was something else that that Tompkins said was happening up there at Medford, as I said, that there were two Navy officers that have said that yes, Tompkins was indeed talking about these things.
Shasta is very intriguing, and the conference will be excellent as well. For information about that conference, you can go to exopolitics.org. I believe you've got it right on the homepage there on the upper right. Yeah, upper right at the top. Mount Shasta Summer Conference, Part 2, the Secret Space Program. They ought to get Bill Tompkins up there and add him as a speaker as well. That'd be a good one.
Well, I'll definitely be talking about Bill's testimony and the organizer wants to get Bill up there at some point.
I'd like to... hold on here. Let me see. August 26th, 27th, 28th. That's Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Jeff doesn't travel much, but I may have to travel. An hour and a half. Everyone laughs. An hour and a half. I really should come down and say hello, Michael, and take this in. That's going to be a very good one. One of the few.
It'll be great to have you there.
Well, thank you. I have been invited so many times to conferences, and I don't have the time, and I just don't do it. But this is a very special one. The Mount Shasta Summer Conference, August 26, 27, 28, the weekend. And for any of you who can get there, I would urge you to go. This is going to be a very unique assemblage of some extremely bright people who are very well informed. Okay, now we are coming up on a break here as well, but what we've been talking about, I would like all of you now to shift mentally to the English hacker who did this with a dial-up telephone, Gary McKinnon. And we'll talk about Gary after the break in more detail. Keep in mind that he hacked into the Pentagon simply looking for proof of extraterrestrial existence. And what he found was apparently way off limits. But the interesting part of it, he said there were other people. It was like this hacker who got into Hillary Clinton's server. He said there were other hackers in there at the same time, and they kind of said hello to each other. And McKinnon said he was aware of other hackers in the Pentagon, too. It was that easy to get in. Pretty dumb back then. And we'll talk more about Gary, because what Gary found substantiates virtually everything that we've talked about tonight. So just remember John Walston's amazing videos of things in orbit, far Earth, medium Earth, near Earth. I'm not sure what they were. I think they varied. But these were all obviously enormous machines up there, parked, maybe... getting ready to go on another mission. Large vehicles. Back in just a few minutes. Hold on, and we'll continue. Back talking with Dr. Michael Sala. Now, Gary McKinnon, I remember talking to Gary. Oh, I forgot, a couple of years ago, and he was still concerned. He got into the Pentagon, and he found, and I think most of you know the story, access to the U.S. Navy logs of various vessels and their commanding officers, commanding officer changes and reassignments and so forth. Unfortunately, for the Navy, these ships were spaceships. None of them were in the oceans. They didn't exist. But there they were, full and complete data registries of each one, their commanding officers, and so forth. Gary found those. And the U.S. government spent, I think, it was over 10 years trying to forcefully extradite him from Britain to come over here to stand trial. We all know what they would have done to him over here. They would talk about wiping somebody's mind or wiping him out. But the Brits stood up to it, and eventually the Americans, I guess, gave up. The bottom line is that we think, and Gary suggested, that he saw a lot more than what he did let on. But he didn't want to pay the ultimate price with that knowledge, so he kept it real quiet. But I got that impression from communicating with him that there was a lot more there. This is a very interesting story, Michael. Tell us a little bit more and how you see the exploits of Gary McKinnon.
Well, Gary's is a very interesting case. So one of the things that I found very interesting about it was that after he was found and then extradition, the criminal pro- process began in 2002, mm-hmm. That's when they began the investigation, that at the time, what happened was that Space Command actually was its own distinct command in the U.S. military sphere. I believe it was one out of 10. They had 10 different commands at the time. But at that very same time, as McKinnon hacked into the databases and saw all this information about these U.S. Navy spaceships and fleet-to-fleet transfers and non-terrestrial officers and all of that, that soon after that emerged, that they decided to fold Space Command into Strategic Command. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting. It was almost like, oops, this hacker has found out what is happening, so we're going to have to kind of like, you know, dig or hide this this level of operations down deeper within the kind of military bureaucracy, the way in which they compartmentalize things. So from that day forward, from that time forward, 2002, Space Command was folded into Strategic Command. So you basically had this effort to deal with space now being subsumed under the kind of whole nuclear weapons platform. So that was a very interesting way in which the military handled things at the same time that McKinnon was coming forward with his disclosures. Now, I tend to look at what happened with Gary McKinnon as, okay, so the Department of Justice was in charge of this kind of extradition process, and of course it went on for 10 years.
Yeah.
Also, and then eventually it was the British Home Secretary, Theresa May, I believe, that decided that, well, okay, Gary's kind of been through enough, and we're going to just let it go. And that was the end of the thing. And I can't help but wonder whether or not the U.S. military were really serious about silencing Gary McKinnon, whether this was the way in which you could actually get the public to start opening up to this information. So I wouldn't be surprised that in the one way it was like the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing, that in a way people in the Navy kind of wanted Gary to come forward to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other branches of the U.S. military, or at least the Department of Justice, saying, well, you know, this is terrible. Like, there's been a huge, massive breach of security, because I think all of this happened around the same time as you had the Disclosure Project with Stephen Greer,
yeah.
But also William Tompkins in 2001 was given the go-ahead by this Navy Admiral Hugh Webster to reveal everything that he had experienced. So I think it's very possible that McKinnon was kind of given enough rope to hang himself, but you know, they fed him the rope. They kind of like didn't.
Interesting
really
idea. May well be. If they wanted to shut him up, they'd just kill him. They kill people all the time.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Just not a problem. So yeah, well, I'm glad that Gary is okay, and they did, for whatever reason, finally leave him alone. You know, it reminds me of his hacking and reporting that others were in there as well. Imagine what the Chinese and the Russians are doing by way of hacking into American cyberspace, and vice versa too. It's just the new frontier. It goes on all the time. And then that woman who shall remain nameless, with her State Department, her private server in her bathroom, didn't even have a password, and yet this woman is not being indicted. I mean, it just boggles the mind. Boggles the mind. Okay, politics aside here, I don't like the idea of the government and the military. I don't like gradualism. We have, in my view, a birthright to know what's going on around us. This is not something that our controllers have a right to control for their own greedy national defense and national security reasons. There's much more going on. And then they say, well, if we told people, they might be shocked. I don't think people would be shocked at all. They've been acclimatized to this concept of ET for 65 years, since the early 1950s. Some of those movies were very prescient, and I think that some of them carried information that was deliberately leaked, even back then. So I don't think there's any real valid reason to continue this this official cover-up. I don't really care. But as Clark McClellan on this program so many times made clear, our whole space program was basically a misdirection. In addition to being a German, I'll call it a Nazi operation if you want, they were running the program. But they were also running our space program at the same time. This was this is the big story here. Now, at Mount Shasta this summer, Corey Good, if his mind was wiped, was he able to recover some of what was wiped from it? How does he know with certainty what he's really talking about here? Now, this is a quasi-rhetorical statement to get people interested in the conference.
Sure. Well, what's interesting about Corey is that even though he was subjected to this mind-wiping technology, that he said that he remembered roughly two-thirds to 80%, something like that, of everything that happened to him after he was returned. So the technology essentially didn't work on him. It was probably because he was an intuitive empath, which meant that he was able to connect with a kind of higher intelligence within himself, where memories could be stored there. They couldn't wipe that information. So he remembered that. But what makes Corey unique is that he had that experience as a member of the secret space programs. He did a 20 and back tour of duty. But what's very interesting with him is that in 2011, he was contacted by a group of extraterrestrials that he calls the Sphere Being Alliance.
What does he call them?
He calls them the Sphere Being Alliance.
The Sphere of Being Alliance, okay.
Yes, Sphere Being Alliance, because they appeared around the same time as these giant spheres, some as big as Jupiter, suddenly started appearing in our solar system, either coming from the Kuiper Belt or coming out of the Sun. That he says that around 2011, there was an influx of these giant spheres, and that they were associated with five different extraterrestrial groups that were in an alliance. So he called them the Sphere Being Alliance. Mm-hmm. And basically they began to interact with the different space programs and different extraterrestrial groups here on the Earth and in our solar system. And according to Corey, this group of extraterrestrials had far superior technologies, and so he was approached by them, or he had contact experiences with them, and they designated him to be their delegate in future meetings with the different space programs, so that they could kind of sort out a disclosure process for the planet. That this Sphere Being Alliance was saying that, yes, disclosure, it's about time it happens, and that we're going to help you negotiate your differences or facilitate that process. And so in March of 2015, Corey says that he was taken to the moon by one of these sphere beings. Mm-hmm. And that essentially what happened then was that he was in a conference room, and what occurred was that there were 70 different representatives of 70 different private citizens, as well as officials from the different space programs, making a total of around 200 people at this first conference, where these sphere beings basically formally introduced themselves to the different space programs. Mm-hmm. And since that time, there have been a number of subsequent meetings and unfolding events that are associated with this really kind of very drawn-out negotiation process between the different space programs, different extraterrestrial groups, over when and how much to disclose to the world about the space programs and ETs.
Interesting. Now, with your background, PhD in government affairs, international diplomacy, and the depth of knowledge, you and my friend Carol Rosen and several others, there would easily be a group that I could name of 15 or 20 people that should have been at that meeting. Don't you feel you should have been at that meeting?
Well, that's interesting. According to Corey, the people that were at that meeting, none of them have come forward. I mean, they were drawn from all over the world. I'm not sure as to whether or not, you know, they have been publicly silenced. So if I had gone to that meeting, maybe I would have been one of those that, you know,
would have... They couldn't trust you, Michael. That's why you didn't go. You would have talked.
I would have talked, and that may not have been good. You know, having one person talking about this would have been enough. To have two saying that they were at the same meeting might have been too much.
Right.
But what I find very interesting about Corey in having kind of like analyzed his testimony and tried to verify and vet him as much as I could was that there were all of these incredible synchronicities with official events. So for example, you know, the most recent synchronicity is that, so Corey says that for the last few months there's been this space war being waged around Antarctica and in space between the different space programs. So at the same
our space programs or space programs of visitors?
Our space programs have been fighting one another. In other words, there are multiple space programs. There's the one that was established by the Nazis in Antarctica that Corey calls the Dark Fleet. Mm-hmm. There's another that was established by the military industrial complex that was cooperating with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. He calls that a corporate fleet. It's essentially the interplanetary corporate conglomerate. Then there's the Solar Warden program. So he says that these...
That's U.S. Navy primarily, right?
Exactly, U.S. Navy, but also you have the other program run by the NRO and the U.S. Air Force Space Command, which is a kind of a parallel space program to the Navy with different responsibilities but having less developed technologies, but nevertheless the Earth is something that they're supposed to maintain kind of surveillance and control over. So you have these multiple space programs that have begun hostilities. And so Corey has been describing this. So at the same time as he's saying that this was happening, lo and behold, you have President Obama writing a letter to the Congress saying that he has fulfilled their request as part of the Defense Authorization Act of 2015 to come up with an interagency process to develop an integrated space defense plan against adversaries in space. This literally came out in May of this year. So this is something that I found very interesting with Corey Good's testimony, that when he comes up with this kind of information, there are some political events that provide at least circumstantial evidence that this may in fact be happening. Because here you have President Obama coming up with a report saying that it's designed to respond to these adversaries in space, where you have an interagency effort to come up with an integrated space defense plan.
No, very interesting. I asked earlier who the third modern president was to visit San Carlos de Bariloche. It was Bill Clinton.
Oh, really?
So we have Eisenhower, Bill Clinton. Yeah, October 15th through the 18th, 1997. He went to Bariloche.
Wow.
And then Obama, not too many months ago. So you got three modern presidents, and you suggest Teddy Roosevelt went there as well. Interesting.
I know he was the first, but yeah, I forgot about Clinton. That's a very interesting one. So definitely Bariloche is a very important place politically. Of course, if you accept that the Nazis did develop secret space programs and bases in Antarctica and South America, then it makes sense why these presidents would have gone down there.
Eisenhower, I mean, think of all the places in the world he could have gone. Interesting to think also how Eisenhower, who really hated Germans and Germany, would have gone down there. I'm not saying he did or didn't meet with anyone, but there are whole German towns down there, Bavarian design architecture, and thousands upon thousands, maybe ultimately tens of thousands of Germans, former Nazis in many cases, went down there after the war, in many cases flown down there by American long-range DC-4, four-engine, Douglas cargo planes. They were outfitted with tanks. I have a friend who had a friend who was a P-51 fighter pilot. His squadron at the end of the war was ordered to stand down, stay there, and they were checked out on DC-4s. Well, this guy flew two or three round-trip flights from Europe, stopping at the Canaries, and then on to Argentina with a plane full of Germans and stuff. He was not allowed to go back in there. He wasn't, the people boarded on the opposite side of the plane, so he couldn't see who was going on. But we made a deal. We swapped for technology and the paperclip scientists to allow a lot of German Nazi government people to go to Argentina, Uruguay, Brazil, but primarily to Argentina in the southern part. Not necessarily in the Patagonia, but in the Bariloche area. And this guy was a pilot. He was involved with it. So, that happened. We also have a memo from J. Edgar Hoover in 1947 or 48, who orders his agents to stop looking for Adolf Hitler in Argentina. There's no reason to look for him down there, so we're going to stop. It's like Hoover was not in the loop, and he was brought into the loop, and all of a sudden he was told, call your boys off. We don't want them looking around down there. We made a deal, and the deal is we've got the scientists, we've got the technology, we've got our rocket program, and we have to abide by that. So all interesting stuff. History is bears very little resemblance in the contemporary public consumed profile than in reality. It's just a whole different story. As you know, that's got to be fun for you, too, as a scholar.
Well, it's important to understand the history so that we can understand what is happening today. And I find it very interesting that Obama's visit down there in March of this year coincides with these claims that the elite have been secretly going down en masse to South America and even to Antarctica because they believe that there's going to be some really major social upheavals. And we're kind of seeing that, people are starting to kind of like be more restless, and we're seeing kind of a lot of instability in many cities. And I think...
Oh, my God, look at Europe. We could have certainly race war or geopolitical race war anytime in this country here. All the ingredients are on the table. In Europe, there are 3 to 5 million more immigrants who are set to be hurled at the European Union. Brexit was a fascinating thing. What's your take on being an Aussie? What is your take on Brexit?
Well, I think it's very clear that the whole European Union was essentially a kind of stealth project to bring about a kind of Fourth Reich. I mean, if you look at the Red House report and the attempt to basically have German industrialists be the basis by which a new German Reich could be developed, that
right,
the
right.
European Union was the ideal platform for that. And I think that the Brits have kind of like seen that for what it is, and so that they don't want to be part of a super state where the parliament is just a rubber stamp for these faceless bureaucrats that make laws and push them through all at the dictates of these industrialists operating behind the scenes.
Yeah, Mrs. Merkel said, "Don't worry, Germany will never lose Europe." So figure that one out. It kind of locks steps with what you just said. I frankly have a little hunch that may be wrong, of course, that the Queen was very tired of being involved with the EU, and I think she was photographed smiling after Brexit, so there's a lot to be said for that. I think she wanted out, too. So, interesting. Crazy times, Michael.
Well, very interesting times now. I'm very heartened by what the British have done, because I think that they have set in process something that might lead to the unraveling of this kind of Fourth Reich enterprise, and that's going to accelerate the disclosure project, I think.
I concur. Thank you for everything you do, Michael. You've made marvelous contributions, and you're not close to being finished. You have much to do here, so we'll stay in touch and have you back on again if you'd like.
Thank you. Look forward to it. All the best. Aloha.
Okay. Good night. Dr. Michael Sala from Hawaii. And we're going to pause on that note. Come right back with Hour 3.